is it that we find ourselves surrounded by such complexity, such elegance?
The genes of you and me, the genes of you and me, we're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA.
Hello, you're listening to DNA Today, a genetics podcast and radio show. I'm your host, Kira Dineen. DNA Today informs you on what's happening in the genetic world. During my broadcast, I educate the public on genetic and health topics through event coverage, news stories, book movie reviews, and interviews. Guests include genetic counselors, researchers, patient advocates, and professors in the field of genetics. Joining me today is second-time guest, Georgia Hurst. She's a Lynch syndrome advocate with her roles as founder and executive director of the nonprofit IHaveLynchSyndrome.com, which it's a fantastic resource for people to learn about Lynch syndrome. I've used it for my own studies to kind of understand Lynch syndrome better. And it's also a great resource to read her personal blog posts on her experiences. Georgia has Lynch syndrome, which is an inherited disorder that increases the risk of many types of cancers, particularly cancers of the colon and rectum, and also reproductive organs in women, depending on which of the five Lynch syndrome mutations they hold. Her mission is to educate doctors and the public around the globe about Lynch syndrome, which is what she's going to do on the program today. So thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me. How are you?
Good, good. I'm so glad that you're coming back on after it's been about a year and a half since you've been on.
Yeah, quite a bit has happened since then.
Definitely. Yeah, we're going to catch up on the documentary we talked about, Pink and Blue, the tweet chat, and kind of relearn some stuff about Lynch syndrome and see what's new.
Sounds good to me. Let's do it.
So let's start with what Lynch syndrome is. I kind of gave a little bit of a teaser, but you know much more. So kind of take it away there.
So it's a hereditary cancer syndrome that increases your risk of colon cancer and various other cancers. Historically, it's been known as hereditary non-polyposis colorectal cancer, or HNPCC. But we've decided to forget that and call it Lynch syndrome because it involves more than just colorectal cancer.
And it's also easier for people to remember too, right?
Yes. A number of inherited risks can increase your risk of colon cancer, but Lynch is the most common, and doctors estimate that about 3 out of every 100 colon cancers are caused by Lynch syndrome.
Which is really a lot when you think about it. That you imagine that colon cancer is kind of one of the cancers that are higher up on the list of affecting people. 3 out of 100 may seem like, oh, it's only 3%, but comes down to it being caused by this hereditary cancer syndrome. To me, that's a big number.
Yeah, so there's about 1 million people in the United States that have Lynch syndrome, and only about 5% of us have been diagnosed with it.
So that's vastly underdiagnosed.
Absolutely. It's not deemed rare in the United States, but it's definitely underdiagnosed. So right now, there's a little over 50,000 people that are aware of the fact that they have Lynch syndrome. The greatest issue that we have in the Lynch community is that only 30% of the population that actually knows they have Lynch syndrome is being screened properly. So even though people know they have Lynch syndrome, many of them have doctors who are not well-versed and who don't know what the proper screening protocols require. And so many people are developing cancer and unfortunately dying as a result.
So what would be some of those preventative measures or kind of screening things you're talking about in terms of having Lynch syndrome versus someone that doesn't have Lynch syndrome? What are those differences?
My doctors are very vigilant with me because my brother died at the age of 36 from colon cancer. And my other brother developed colon cancer at the age of 48.
Very young.
So for me, they recommend, and you know, this is very particular to my family history. It varies with everybody, but generally they recommend scopes every 1 to 2 years. For me, I get scoped every single year, and I go to Mayo Clinic, and I'm there for about 3 to 4 days, and they run a series of tests and do scopes and scans, and they look pretty much for everything imaginable because we're at risk for about a dozen different cancers. So I have a special colonoscopy. They also do an endoscopy. And I actually had a very flat polyp that the doctor found in May. He said that had anyone else done the scope, they probably would have missed it because it was that flat. So the problem is that Lynch syndrome tends to present with very flat polyps, and special colonoscopies are required. And so these special scopes, whether they're using dye or particular cameras, they're able to detect these very flat polyps, unlike traditional colonoscopies. So you really need to have somebody who knows Lynch syndrome and what these flat polyps may look like.
They're going to be a little bit, have a more keen eye to seeing those types of polyps as opposed to what they may see in someone that doesn't have Lynch syndrome.
Correct. Fortunately, he was able to remove that. And then everything else was fine. I was diagnosed with Barrett's esophagus, which is basically the precursor to esophageal cancer if it's not remedied. You know, that's something that I'm trying to manage with antacids and diet and, you know, changing some of my habits. So other than that, I'm healthy.
And as we said before, it's not just colon and rectal cancer that can be affected and develop in people that have Lynch syndrome. You just mentioned esophageal cancer. So there's lots of different cancers that have an elevated risk of being developed in those with Lynch syndrome.
Yes, we're talking like there's elevated risk of uterine, stomach, ovary, bile ducts, small bowel, urinary tract, the brain, skin and the pancreas, bladder, liver, kidneys, pretty much everything except the lungs, I think.
So what is the testing for Lynch syndrome? How can someone find out if they have it? And what's the kind of best approach in starting that process of seeing if you have Lynch syndrome and learning about the syndrome?
You can be tested for it with a simple blood test or a saliva test. But the best thing to do, in my opinion, is to see a certified genetic counselor to determine whether or not you would be a good candidate for genetic testing. There are many implications to genetic testing that some people are unaware of, especially when they're being tested through their doctor without seeing a genetic counselor. Genetic testing may hold implications for life insurance, long-term disability insurance, and other things. So these are things that a genetic counselor will discuss with you prior to genetic testing. A number of people have called me and told me that they're very upset because they have found out that they're no longer eligible for life insurance because of this, or long-term disability. And so it can be quite problematic. So that's why I strongly encourage people to see certified genetic counselors. They're also fonts of knowledge and can provide you with tremendous resources to kind of help you navigate through your Lynch journey.
Genetic counselors are kind of guides in this, and that they won't tell you what to do, but they're kind of that like guidance counselor and saying, all right, here's the information you have. Let's see what tests you're good for, and let me help you, pointing you to advocacy groups and support groups such as IHaveLynchSyndrome.com. But genetic counselors are someday I want to be a genetic counselor, but genetic counselors have 2 years of master's level training, so they are really up to date on what's happening, and they have the resources to look at new research and seeing where science really is in order to help you kind of figure out as much as you can about your health.
Absolutely. And, you know, they can also keep you abreast to any new information about your particular mutation. They can let you know about clinical studies. They can help with coding issues regarding screenings and tests. You know, they really are a valuable resource for those with hereditary cancer syndromes. And I just can't say enough positive things about them. I believe there's this misconception that we don't have enough of them. I think they're underutilized, so I don't believe it's fair to say we don't have enough of them. I think it was 36% of women who have been tested for BRCA, not BRCA, BRCA.
Yes, pet peeve of mine.
Have seen a genetic counselor, which is very problematic because they're going through the motions of undergoing these prophylactic hysterectomies and oophorectomies and double mastectomies. But there also may be a great possibility that they're at risk for other cancers, such as colon cancer. So a genetic counselor can really dive into their family medical history to see what other cancers they may be at risk for. Because a lot of women who are previvors with BRCA think once they undergo these prophylactic surgeries, they're done. When in fact, some of them are not. They need to be screened on a regular basis for other cancers as well.
And even having prophylactic surgeries to prevent cancer from developing, it's not a 0% chance. Most of the time it goes down to, if you have the BRCA mutation, it can go down to 5% chance of developing the cancer. So it's, you know, science is never hundreds and zeros, I kind of think. It greatly, greatly reduces your risk. If you have a BRCA mutation, you can have up to an 85% risk of developing cancer. So 85 to 5 is a, you know, huge decrease in that. Prophylactic surgeries for Lynch syndrome are similar to that, right?
That's correct. These are risk-reducing surgeries, not necessarily life-saving. So, yeah, you're significantly reducing your chances of developing cancer, but you don't eliminate the risk entirely. So even though women who undergo the prophylactic oophorectomy, which is the removal of the ovaries, they can still be at risk for peritoneal cancer. So it's recommended they undergo a CA125 blood test, which is a cancer antigen blood test to determine whether or not they have elevated levels of this cancer antigen, because microscopic tissue can be left over from the ovaries. And that can cause cancer. So usually by the time it's caught, it's too late because the screening right now for ovarian cancer is very poor.
Very poor. So, it's probably one of the poorest in terms of different cancers and what we have for each type of cancer in terms of looking at how far it's advanced. And
absolutely. The risk for developing peritoneal cancer is actually less than the general population after you have the surgery, from what I understand, but there still is a risk.
Genetic counseling is very important in terms of going through genetic testing because they really can guide you and they have that experience of schooling and being certified in most cases, but there are people that are practicing genetic counseling that aren't certified. What's the difference there, I guess, and what should people be mindful of when they're going to seek out a genetic counselor?
A lot of people who are performing genetic testing are pretending to be genetic counselors. They are not certified genetic counselors. A certified genetic counselor is someone you make an appointment with and you go and you see and you speak with them, and occasionally, a geneticist will come in and also possibly do the consult with them. You know, they are highly trained. Like you said earlier, they go through a very extensive, rigorous 2-year master's program to become genetic counselors. So, you know, they are very knowledgeable about various hereditary cancer syndromes, can determine whether or not you're at risk, whether or not you should be genetically tested, and they can provide you with all the information you need to know to make an informed decision as to whether or not you should be genetically tested. I think one of the biggest problems with genetic counselors is the word counseling. I think people believe there's some kind of psychological component involved. You know, they're not there to psychoanalyze you. They're there to kind of guide you through this process and to help you make an informed decision as to whether or not you should be tested.
I think the counseling term definitely does throw people off, because if I'm talking to someone and say, yes, I'd like to, you know, go into genetic counseling and that's kind of my next step in my career, people are like, oh, so you're going to make designer babies. I would say 9 out of 10 times that's the response I get if I'm talking to someone that's not in the science field or not a science major. And the counseling aspect, as you said, they're not there to, you know, psychoanalyze you or anything like that. But the counseling aspect is more that there is training in terms of, you know, sociology and psychology within that 2 years master's program that kind of prepares them to talk with people. And oftentimes when people are getting genetic counseling and going for genetic testing, or at least learning about it to make that decision, they have maybe family issues, or that they've had a family member die from a cancer that maybe that they are getting hereditary testing for. So there's a lot of things that can happen in a genetic counseling session that a genetic counselor is prepared to kind of be in a counselor type role and saying, well, how are you feeling about that? Or how has this affected you? Or maybe talking about a child that they may have had die in the past, and kind of being able to have that training in terms of the psychology and the sociology. So yes, it's not necessarily a therapy session, but there's definitely, genetic counselors do have those kind of therapist skills in there.
Absolutely. And I think the one thing that's really important to note is that, you know, it's not one size fits all. And our society is so diverse, and with various socioeconomic groups and ethnicities, you know, that just adds to the complexity of everything. So genetic counselors are prepared to deal with a lot of these different challenges that various groups are up against. You know, they can talk about a lot of the social stigmas which surround hereditary cancer syndromes, etc. So, you know, I really push a lot for people to see certified genetic counselors before and after testing.
And one of the things that genetic counselors can explain during a session that is talking about Lynch syndrome, if the patient maybe has been diagnosed with Lynch syndrome at this point, is the inheritance pattern. So as our expert on the show, can you explain what the inheritance pattern is in Lynch syndrome?
So it's deemed autosomal dominant. So if a parent has it, each child of that parent has a 50-50 chance of holding the mutation as well. I've had people call me and say, so only half my kids are at risk? And no, it's not half your kids. Each child has a 50-50 chance.
So every time that someone has a child, it's a flip of a coin whether they would inherit Lynch syndrome or not, for every single kid.
Exactly.
You've discovered that you have Lynch syndrome, and you've written about this on ihavelynchsyndrome.com. How did you go about discovering? Did you see a genetic counselor? What was the process in discovering that you and family members of yours have and had Lynch syndrome?
Well, I think I mentioned previously that my eldest brother died at the age of 36 from colon cancer in 1995. And at that point, I knew there must be some genetic component because of his age. And I have a background in science. And, you know, I had some genetics in my undergrad training. And I knew that other family members had had colon cancer, but they were a little older. Then my second brother was diagnosed with colon cancer about 6 years ago, and he was 48 years old. And fortunately, his doctor knew about Lynch syndrome and had him genetically tested. He tested positive, and soon thereafter, he contacted me and told me that I needed to be genetically tested. So I spoke with my gastro, and he referred me to a certified genetic counselor. And I saw a counselor, and I did not get tested right away. I thought about it for a week, and then I went back and I got tested. And then 4 weeks later, I discovered that I tested positive.
And which mutation were you tested positive for?
MLH1, which is one of the most common ones.
And since finding that out, how has Lynch syndrome affected your family from finding out the genetic test, but also kind of in retrospect of now knowing that you have a genetic mutation that has affected multiple family members?
Within my marriage and my son, I would say it's been very difficult. It has profoundly changed my life. Removing my ovaries changed my being significantly, and I'm not the same woman I was before. It's changed my personality a lot. I used to be very extroverted and very energetic and very happy. And life following surgery became very difficult for many years. I was not on the correct dosage of hormone replacement therapy. It took many years for them to tweak it. It took a long time for me to get used to my new body. So it's been pretty difficult. And fortunately, you know, I've been able to get the appropriate help. You know, I deal with those who have been suffering in silence for a long time. And so a lot of my advocacy is geared towards helping them get the resources they need to improve the quality of their lives.
So reaching out to those within the community, I imagine you really help them in ways that you wish someone was kind of there to guide you when you were getting your surgeries before and post-surgery of, you know, not having that appropriate hormone replacement therapy. And kind of, is that kind of the direction that you take advocacy work in helping those that are going through what you've been through?
Actually, I don't reach out to them. They reach out to me. I get several emails a week from people all over the world looking for help, trying to find genetic counselors, trying to find doctors who are well-versed in protocols, trying, you know, to find psychotherapists who specialize in people with hereditary cancer syndromes, trying to get into clinical trials, needing assistance for getting access to meds that they need. You know, I basically try to create a space that I wish would have been available to me when I was diagnosed. So people know that they can reach out to me 24/7, every day, any day. I'm always available to them. So I try to help them to the best of my ability. I just wanted to create a very safe space, you know, where people knew that there was someone out there that cared, who knows what it's like, and who would be willing to help them.
Definitely. And I really want to thank you on behalf of the hereditary cancer syndrome community of being there. And you're always very active on Twitter and responding to people. And just, as you said, 24/7 being there for people as really an expert in the field of personally going through it. But also, I see you're always reading, you know, the new research. What has been new in terms of research in the Lynch syndrome community?
I would say the greatest advancement thus far has been immunotherapy. And it's been showing a lot of promise for those with Lynch. And unlike traditional approaches such as chemotherapy, immunotherapy harnesses the tremendous power of the body's immune system. And the upside to immunotherapy is that there seems to be far fewer negative side effects from it in comparison to traditional chemotherapy. I had a woman in Florida reach out to me, and she had renal cell carcinoma, and they gave her less than a year to live. And I was able to get her into a clinical trial, and she is now, she extended her death date now by a year.
Wow.
And she's very well, and they can't even find the cancer anymore on the scans. So she's doing very, very well. She's in her 80s. She survived the Second World War. She survived polio. She's quite a pistol. And she's doing very, very well. I believe this was her third Lynch cancer.
Wow.
So
that's definitely quite a journey.
And she's doing remarkably well. And I speak to her on a frequent basis. She's doing really well. There's another woman who's going through the clinical trial for immunotherapy. And it seems to be working for her as well. You know, I want people to know they can reach out to me. I can help them get into clinical trials quickly. So, you know, when all else fails, please reach out to me and I will help you get you in as soon as possible.
Your advocacy work extends beyond Lynch syndrome. That's what we've discussed so far. But the last time you were on the program, you were joined by Amy Beyer-Shaneman, the executive producer of Pink and Blue. Can you remind our listeners what the documentary is about?
So Amy Beyer-Shaneman is also known as the BRCA responder on Twitter, and she is the top advocate for the BRCA community. And she and I met on a tweet chat a few years ago. She and I were actually at similar points in our journeys after our ovaries were removed. And she really took a liking to my dark humor on Twitter about, you know, life sans ovaries. And so she and I have become best friends. She is the executive producer of this amazing documentary called Pink and Blue. It basically talks about the emotional aspects of women and men who are diagnosed with BRCA1 and 2. It shows them with their doctors making tough decisions as to whether or not they should go through with these preventative surgeries. And the director, who's Alan Glassberg, he's an amazing guy. He tells the story of how the disease has ripped his family apart whilst he is BRCA2 positive himself. The film highlights the fact that men can also carry the BRCA mutation and hold implications for them as well. It's breast cancer is solely not for women. BRCA also affects men. That's what the movie really tries to highlight and educate about.
Male breast cancer is something that, as you said, really isn't talked about as much as female breast cancer. So it's fantastic that you guys are able to highlight that in the documentary. What is the update with the documentary?
So I'm actually showing it in Chicago on Thursday, December 1st. If you visit ihavelynchsyndrome.com, you can see the link for more information, or you can go to tugg.com. to find out more about the Chicago screening. It's at 7:30 at the Roosevelt Collection Carasotti's Movie Theater. Alan Matloff is coming in, and Amy's also coming in. So the three of us will be there together, which is going to be great because Alan is another one of my dearest friends.
And for those that can't attend and go to Chicago like myself, it can be accessed on iTunes, and I'll include the link in the show notes. Or I'm sure you can just search Pink and Blue on iTunes and find that. But mentioning Ellen, you guys have a tweet chat, you, Amy, and Ellen Matloff. So what's the next topic of the tweet chat? Who's the special guest coming up?
Siddhartha Mukherjee. And so he's the author of the gene. He wrote the Pulitzer Prize winning book, The Emperor of All Maladies. And he's an amazing, phenomenal scientist. And he's such a remarkable writer, and he's able to synthesize information from various sources. And he just writes so beautifully. And the gene was my summer reading book, and I pretty much devoured it within about a week. And it's like, I think it's over 500 pages.
Yeah, it's a thick book. I'm looking at it right now.
Yeah, it's a stellar book. So I highly recommend it. He agreed to being our next guest. So we're very excited to have him.
I'm really excited to join in. It's going to be December 5th. That's correct?
That is correct. December 5th at 1 p.m. Eastern time.
And people can join in by just searching on, if you go on Twitter and you search hashtag GenCSM, stands for cancer or genetic cancer social media, you can then look at the tweet chat happening again. It's December 5th at 1 p.m. Eastern time. He's going to be on there answering questions, and we're really going to have an awesome conversation with him and everyone else that joins in. So anyone can join in. It's a really big tweet chat.
It is the tweet chat of the year. yeah, we're really excited about it. And I'm very, very excited. I've never been more excited about a tweet chat before.
Definitely.
So we're very flattered that he's agreed to do this.
That wraps up today's episode of DNA Today. Thank you so much, Georgia, for coming on and sharing your expertise in Lynch syndrome and other hereditary cancer syndromes.
Thank you for having me.
People can visit ihavelynchsyndrome.com, as we've been saying throughout the episode, for really all the information we've been discussing. It's a fantastic resource, really, to just kind of bop around on and learn different things, whether you're a student and looking for kind of a patient aspect on things, or you're a fellow patient and want to hear from someone who's really been through a lot of this and has been researching things and really learning things about Lynch syndrome. If you're interested in following on Twitter, Georgia's at SheWithLynch, and on Facebook at I Have a Lynch Syndrome. For information on the show here, you can go to dnapodcast.com. It is a new website, so definitely check it out. It's not the old one I had before. And let me know what you think. I'm always up for feedback and, you know, seeing how I can improve the site and all that. Also on Twitter at DNA Podcast. And any questions for myself or Georgia can be sent to info@dnapodcast.com. I think that's all of our plugs. That's a lot right there. Thanks for listening, and join me next week to learn and discover new advances in the world of genetics.